Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. As we roll through together, I'm in the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. John Solomon, CBSSports.com, coming up in a few moments. Later, we'll have Tony Knopf, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, Kimberly Jones from NFL Network, and Dieter Kurtenbach on all the money being spent from FoxSports.com. As we told you earlier in the week, Tim Frazier signed a two-year, $4.1 million deal with the New Orleans Pelicans. But, of course, we all know bigger money was doled out over the last few weeks in the NBA, and Dieter Kurtenbach is going to join us to talk about that. But let's start out the show. John Solomon, CBSSports.com, and he's been really one of the guys that's been way out in front on the Baylor story, for instance. John, you're a sports reporter. It's not the easiest thing to make a transition over to cover something like this. How different and how difficult at times has it been?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it I'm following advice from outstanding reporting by some other people on who have been digging into it for a while now. It's people at Texas Monthly, like Jessica Luther, Paula Levine, and Mark Schlabaugh at ESPN. Paula's really done a bulk of the work, and it's just done some really fine work. It's just been a really disturbing story, you know, to see. And I think, you know, everyone understands to an extent that there is going to be behavioral issues with young people on campus. That's understood. Football players, athletes, non-athletes, that happens. You don't want it to happen. You have to take precautions against it. But then the big issue here is then how the adults, how the coaches or the administrators, the university as a whole, reacts to the allegations. What are their actions? What do they do? What do they not do? And in this case, it appears to be a lot of what they didn't do, a lot of inaction that just has so many people upset. And even to this day, as they've investigated it, Baylor just still could not tell a lot of these rape victims and students and concerned alumni whether they're going to release the report that their law firm has put together to figure out sort of what happened. And so it's just been a whole lot of words by Baylor and not much transparency. And until now, assuming the report is accurate, with Ken Starr being out as chancellor, not a whole lot of accountability.
Is it more difficult to cover a private school in terms of trying to get information as opposed to a public school?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, and some public schools can be difficult as well, just depending on what their state open record laws are. But no doubt a private university is extremely difficult because they're private and they're not bound by the public record laws in order to get some of that information. In this case with Baylor, it also was appeared to be the Waco Police Department not having some of these police reports and details public, and it's not really clear why some of these reports weren't public. So that's part of the equation too. And then also there is a new law in Texas that requires police departments, even at private universities, campus police departments, to produce some public information regarding some of these reports. And the Texas Attorney General just came back with an opinion on this last week, saying that Baylor is going to have to turn over some information, not necessarily all, but some from other police reports, other requests that have been made by media outlets. So I suspect we're going to see more stories about Baylor in the future.
2 weeks ago today, you put out a story about Penn State. It's my understanding, I talked to James Franklin, you actually had done a lot of legwork on the story before then. More stuff had been released. In the end, what were some things, some themes in that story that struck you about Penn State and the future of it with James Franklin in charge?
Yeah, it really was a story going into it, just sort of looking at the state of the program and the state of where they are post-Paterno, and with that still that divide and that give and take and that pull between different supporters of the program about how to honor his legacy. And a lot of the reporting came before the additional information then came out that we saw in those court cases. So they had to sort of adapt a little bit on the fly. But what stood out to me just in the reporting was, even before those latest accusations came out from the court case, there was just still this divide about how to honor him. And I really wonder if Penn State is going to be able to be as good as it can be, you know, as university as a whole, and it's still a fine, tremendous university, and also as a football program. Can it be as good as it can be without getting past this? I mean, at some point, I just wonder if this is going to take decades as opposed to, you know, just five or so years before they can really unite again. I've seen this in some other universities. I used to be a Clemson beat reporter, and I covered them around 1999 to 2005, and there was still the remnants of the ouster of Danny Ford as the football coach, and that was 1990.
Right.
I grew up in the Maryland area when Len Bias died, and the aftermath of that, and that took a decade or so. And these things can really linger.
What strikes you about James Franklin that would let you say, you know what, he has the ability to make this happen?
Well, I don't know. I don't know one way or another yet.
Okay.
James Franklin. I think the jury's still out a little bit. I think it still seems like from some fans that the jury is still out. He has brought in some pretty good recruiting classes based on rankings. Saquon Barkley certainly has turned into a really fine player.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is fair to say that I don't think many football programs across the country would have done a whole lot better than what Penn State's done the past couple of years, given the sanctions, given how negative the exposure has been to the program because of what happened with Sandusky, and to still go to a couple bowl games and still win, you know, seven games or so, it shows it didn't collapse. You know, the program didn't collapse. But having said that, you still need the coach and the fan base on the same page, and I'm not sure if that's ultimately going to be the case, but, you know, we'll see.
You also have to deal with the element of money, and the Big Ten, including Penn State, appears to be on the doorstep of them reaping a lot of money. The Sports Business Journal reported the possibility of a contract with Fox just for one tier of the rights. What kind of separation is being created between the SEC, the Big Ten, and the other Power Five conferences based on contracts?
It's a pretty big gap. I mean, even just looking at last year, before this new Big Ten deal, and when the SEC network deal first kicked in and got some tax return forms in 2014-15, and the Big 12 payout was about, per school, was about $10 million less than the SEC. The Pac-12 payout was about $8 million less. The Big Ten was already ahead, not by that amount, but they're going to continue to go ahead because they've got the Big Ten network, because of this new revenue. And this really has been a trend you've been seeing happening here for a couple years now, and that is, you've got a new tier, and it's the Big Ten SEC up at 1A, 1B, however you label them. Then the other three Power Five, Big 12, ACC, Pac-12, and then the rest of FBS. That doesn't in and of itself mean that the other major conferences can't compete for national titles. I don't think that's necessarily the case. Clemson was really close to winning a national championship last year. You can have all the money in the world and still not know how to use it or still hire the wrong people. You know, look at Texas for the longest period of time. But it does give you built-in advantages to really help you on some of those areas.
John, we just went through the NFL draft. There are several players that went undrafted. The NBA has modified its system in terms of how long you can stay in the evaluation period before deciding whether or not to go back. Some guys have hired agents like Diamond Stone and so forth. What should the pro leagues, what should they do to adapt to the college game that gives players better evaluations on staying or going?
Well, I think one thing, at least for college football, is giving the players more time to make their decisions and get the information. Look, at least what the NBA and the NCAA has done with college basketball is giving them some more time. They've been able to go through some of the combines, work out individually for teams, and then the players get a better idea, a better picture. Okay, where do I really stand? And then you make the call, you know, at that point, one way or another. But for the NFL, you're looking at NFL draft deadline for underclassmen around like January 18th or so,
right,
a week after the national championship game,
right,
before the NFL combine, before individual workouts, pro days, all of that. And I don't think it's very fair to the players. I wrote a column this a couple weeks ago. I'm of the opinion, I think the NCAA should let undrafted underclassmen in football and basketball back in. If they want to come back, I don't see the harm in letting them come back.
Is one of the issues, of course, is that in college basketball, you have an early signing period. Now, Spike Albrecht got caught up in this and then eventually he had to transfer to Purdue. But in college football, the signing date is, what, 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks after the declaration date. How would you adapt that if you're going to give players more time to decide whether they're staying or going?
Yeah, no doubt that would be a challenge. It's something you'd have to work through. Not saying it's a perfect scenario. But
but I'm with you on that. I'm with you on this.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how can this be massaged to make it work?
Right. Well, I mean, we do see attrition anyway right now in college football, right, during spring.
That's right.
Even in the summer sometimes. We see players coming and going. They're deciding to transfer. Maybe they've been kicked out. Scholarships get added, maybe the walk-ons. We see graduate transfers. They have to finish up their college work at their old school in order to go to somewhere else and graduate. So it's not like attrition isn't happening right now. Right. I just think you have to start with the premise, at least first, of, okay, we do believe that we should give these players more time or the ability to come back to school. And if you start with that premise, then you figure out the details. But what happens a lot of times in college sports, and it's understandable to an extent because coaches are based on winnings, wins, and losses, and that's why they're fired and hired. But the players are viewed as assets. You know, they're viewed as, to your point, you're right. Oh no, we don't know how many players we're able to sign right now because these players are maybe leaving or maybe coming back, and that's a real issue. Mm-hmm. But it's also an issue because they're viewed as asset to the program, and, you know, and property in a sense. And so if you view it differently and view it as what we are always told this is the mission of college sports, view it educationally, okay, why not allow the players to come back if they're undrafted? And that gives them a carrot to continue to work towards towards graduation by continuing to play, assuming that they want to come back, assuming they're academically eligible, and maybe have some other conditions in there, but I think it's something to explore.
I think the other part, too, is I don't think a lot of people realize probably 70% of the programs are not at 85 anyway.
Absolutely.
So, and that's something a lot of people don't. I think they hear the number 85, they assume everybody's at 85. Most schools are at 81, 82, somewhere in that neighborhood anyway. I want to get back to the Baylor thing for a moment. You wrote a column, very thoughtful column, Baylor, quote, of all schools should know actions matter more than words. Now, obviously, it's a different regime at a different time, but it's not as if they, as a school, as a university, they haven't gone through this before. Is it disturbing that it appears on the surface they didn't learn anything?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Baylor, of all schools,
yep,
given what they went through in 03, should know this. And when we talk NCAA scandals, to me, Baylor and Dave Bliss is like up at the top of all time. I mean, when you have a basketball coach who decides to disparage with false allegations against a deceased basketball player murdered by another basketball player,
right,
in order for the coach to cover up his NCAA violations, like, that's about as bad as he can get. And that was only in 2003. I mean, not really that long ago, 13 years ago. And some of the people in position now were hired after that. They were hired to clean this up. And yet here we are with some of the same questions, about whether there's been cover-ups and whether they've been, you know, forthcoming enough.
John, you have to cover a wide variety of stories. What stories do you like to write? What are the ones that, you know, when you get that idea or get that assignment, you can't wait to attack it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I like digging into issue stories, such as Baylor or, okay, Penn State, or just, being able to dig into one topic and go deeper into it rather than just the, whatever the headlines are for page views or, whatever people are chattering about, trying to find out more information. I like a lot of the legal issues. I follow the O'Bannon case and a lot of the NCAA lawsuits quite a bit. But then just stories about programs and how they sort of evolve over time, such as the Penn State story was interesting.
Very, very interesting. I mean, no question about that. Now, what's also interesting is that this is supposed to be the slowest time of the year.
There's always stories.
When did it stop being this? When did college football, in your mind, stop being ever slow?
Yeah, you know what? There actually still can be slow times, and I think we've even seen it some in recent weeks. maybe writing about it here later this week, about all the chatter about this college football commissioner idea.
Yeah.
To me, that's a sign of like how overexposed football, college football
right.
is, and that, oh, we have to talk about something here in May, April and May, and let's gin up sort of this idea about a college football commissioner that, well, I think there's some decent ideas associated with it. I just don't see how practically it would ever happen.
Where do you think college football is now, in your opinion, in terms of popularity, how it's run, and where can it improve?
Well, it's incredibly popular. I mean, you know, you just look at the media rights deals. You look at some of the TV ratings. Now, the cord cutting is happening with cable, so that's becoming an issue for media rights, at least for some conferences. You'd like college football to be a little bit wiser in terms of when they play their semifinal games, and not just bow to what a couple bowl games and conferences won. It just makes no sense to me to play those on New Year's Eve, and then you have the Rose Bowl or some other games that are, you know, decent games, but January 1st should be your biggest games.
Yeah.
Outside the national championship, 10 days later, whatever. January 1st should always be the semifinals.
Yeah, we were at the Tax Slayer Bowl, so our group, Jack Ham, myself, we were sitting there on New Year's Eve, and we're looking at each other like, this makes no sense. It makes no sense. The next day, it's like, okay, fine, it's New Year's Day. But New Year's Eve made no sense. Okay. Hey, John, absolute pleasure. Very enlightening, and really enjoy reading your stuff. You really get in depth with some things, and you attack a lot of stuff.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
John Solomon, CBSSports.com. Great to have him with us on the show to talk about that. Give us his perspective. Still to come, Kimberly Jones from NFL Network. Tony Knopp, CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management. Dieter Kurtenbach from Fox Sports and all the money that has been doled out in the NBA. Over the past 2 weeks, it's been a remarkable two-week run since July 1 rolled around, between $2 and $3 billion doled out by NBA teams to players. TV contract has a lot to do with that. Dieter Kurtenbach will talk about that when we come back a little bit later. We have Dieter on in the second hour of the show. Coming up, Kimberly Jones from NFL Network. She'll join us. The bottom of the hour we go, a news update, and then this day in sports history on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Saving money on your next vehicle is as easy as SMC.
Sun Mary Motor Company.
Since 1915, SMC provides total commitment to complete customer satisfaction. Sunbury Motor sells and services new Fords, Lincolns, and Hyundais in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and new Kias on the Golden Strip in Hummel's Wharf. No one beats Sunbury Motor Company's lowest price promise. Check them out at sunburymotors.com. SMC, a tradition of trust since 1915.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. We're in the Sunbury Motors Studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Later in the week, Solomon Wilcots is going to join. I think we're going to have him on tomorrow's show, working on John Auerrand from Sports Business Journal. He'll be on before the week is out as well. Tony DeFazio, Pittsburgh Sports Report on Friday as well. So we've got a big week still to come here on the show and some big-name guests to go through. And with John Auerrand, what we want to talk to him about are the massive contracts that the Big Ten will announce before the month is out, I believe, with CBS, ESPN, and most particularly with Fox Sports. It pretty much is set here. They're just going through the contract language. But we'll have that on before the week is out. And Solomon Wilcots, looks like we got Solly on the show tomorrow. Solomon Wilcots joining us. We'll talk about the NFL. We're going to talk with Kimberly Jones about the NFL in a few moments. First of all, this day in sports history. And this day in sports history, 1985, the New York Yankees retired number 9 for Roger Maris and number 32 for Elston Howard. 1999, the American League behind Pedro Martinez won the All-Star Game 4-1 at Fenway Park. That was the night that Ted Williams was wheeled out and all the All-Stars gathered around him on the mound. And 2 years ago today, 2014, Germany beat Argentina 1-0 to win the 20th World Cup. That is this day in sports history. Maybe next year around this time, we may be doing this day in sports history saying, oh, and on this day, Ryan Fitzpatrick finally signed his contract. Still unsigned, Kimberly Jones from NFL Network, longtime friend. Great to have her with us. And it's been obviously quite a saga. You're in the perfect spot. That's one thing about the Jets. They certainly give you, Kim, a lot to talk about, including Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Well, I think he signs after a conversation I had with someone yesterday from the Jets. I'm certain he's going to sign. Now, could things break down? They could. My take on it all along has been Ryan Fitzpatrick, and sometimes in more particular, Ryan Fitzpatrick's agent, can't have Fitzpatrick, who very much wants to be a Jet again and very much wants to throw the ball to Brandon Marshall and Eric Decker and probably Matt Forte and everything else. They can't run to the table with this kind of deal. They just can't. And I think there's some of that sort of contract gamesmanship going on. Will the Jets improve their offer? Probably a little bit. Will it look better in the end? Probably a little bit. And we'll all look at the guarantees and say, by the quarterback market, which is incredibly nuts when you look at Brock Osweiler and Sam Bradford, and even Chase Daniel for a backup, in the quarterback market at the end, he's still going to be quote-unquote underpaid, but I think they'll find something that they can both tolerate.
In the end, is one of the big winners in him signing with the Jets Christian Hackenberg?
Yes, 100%, yes. And I had someone reach out to me who was under a completely different illusion, and I guess that's possible from the outside. I guess. I will tell you, and you're on the right track, Steve, of course. He is a terrific guy. I mean, Fitzpatrick. He's a wonderful leader. He galvanized a locker room that hadn't had an adult at quarterback in an awfully long time and really, really changed the locker room. Did Todd Bowles have something to do with that? Absolutely. But Fitzpatrick was a big, big part of it, and this will sound almost silly if you're not, you know, open-minded enough to really understand it. He had group texts where he was with the offensive linemen. He had group texts where he's talking to Decker and Marshall, at least, and perhaps other receivers as well, in terms of keeping them engaged, sending them video, sending them ideas, floating things back and forth in terms of practice evaluations, that kind of thing. That's not as common as you might think. I mean, I think group texting is, obviously, and these players certainly reach out that way. But he was really a guy that was involved in everything offensively. He threw for a franchise record 31 touchdowns. He will be someone that Christian, in some ways, can really model being a professional after. And I think that's vitally important. Todd Bowles last night, I was at the Jets town hall meeting that's not open to the media, and supposedly I'm not really supposed to talk about what they say, Steve, but they say it to an audience of people, so I think I'm fair in at least characterizing this. Todd Bowles was asked a lot about Christian, more about Fitzpatrick, but a lot about Christian, and one thing he consistently says publicly, privately, anytime you talk to Bowles, his football IQ is off the charts, and they know he has the physical ability. Well, Ryan Fitzpatrick may not have as much physical ability, that word talent that we use too often, but he certainly has a very high football IQ. I really think Hackenberg learning from Fitzpatrick could be a big, big blessing at this point in Christian's pro career.
And despite the fact, you know, you were at the combine here at Haluba Hall at Penn State, and you and I were both really impressed by what we saw from Christian that day. But in reality, it really would benefit him, maybe not to be on the complete Aaron Rodgers program of 4 years, but at least have 2 years to watch this whole thing and learn from somebody who's been around the block and knows game speed.
Game speed.
For sure, and I think the Jets are on that page. They won't exactly lay that out for you. They really can't. They have Geno Smith. They have Bryce Petty. They also know that things in the NFL can change on a dime. You can tear your Achilles on the practice field, and then everything changes. But that would be their pie in the sky as they rebuild a roster that they do believe they have to rebuild. And I think that's also important. Christian, at the end of all of this, or at the beginning of all of this in terms of his on-field playing career, Steve, is not going to be asked to lead a veteran group that says, don't mess this up. He is going to be asked to lead a rebuilt Jets roster that they believe they can put in contention, or excuse me, in position to contend in a couple of years.
Meanwhile, on the other side, the Giants may have a new head coach. They lost a lot of games late last year. You have extensive experience covering the Giants. Why do they always seem so much calmer than the Jets?
Yeah, you know what? They are totally different operations. You know, the Jets haven't made the playoffs in 5 years, the Giants in four, so neither one lately has exactly, you know, distinguished itself. The Giants, of course, at least have the history of more recent Super Bowls. And they, you know, a big, big, big difference, Steve, is the quarterback position, exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
The one thing about Eli, he is solid, he is steady, he's as good a citizen as you're going to find, and at times, as good a quarterback as you're going to find. And meanwhile, the Jets have kind of, you know, I knew them off the top of my head in terms of the numbers of drafted quarterbacks by the Jets, but in the past 10 years, I think it might be eight. I mean, they give this thing a try time after time, and they continually mess it up. And that's why I do believe with Hackenberg they're going to be as insistent as circumstances allow them to be patient and allow him to learn and to grow.
You've done a lot in your career. What is so intriguing to you about covering the NFL, especially at this stage of your career?
Everything matters so much. Everything. Every game is a big game. In September, they're big games. In preseason, mostly because things can go haywire. They're not. I'm not suggesting people should, you know, fill stadiums for preseason games, and as we know, NFL fans don't, and I don't blame them. But things can go haywire in preseason. You can lose a lot more than you can gain in preseason for the most part. So, but when you're talking about regular season games, every one of them matters. I mean, I loved covering the Yankees, and I still love baseball. I'll watch the Yankees tonight. I watch the Mets every time they're on, flipping back and forth. But, you know, not every baseball game is a big game. And I understand if the Pirates miss out by a game, you're going to say, boy, there was that game in June. I get it. But in the course of a baseball season, there are ebbs and flows. The NFL, if you do that, you're going to lose, and you're going to lose big, and it's going to affect your record. There are only 16 of them, as we know, only 17 weeks to a season. Everything in the NFL is big, and it's true, Steve, in April when they release the schedule. It's true, obviously, with the combine, with the pro days, with the draft, with everything the NFL does is a big, big deal. And while people feel that way about it, you know, I think reporting, you certainly have to look at it that way, and I certainly do.
And that's one of the interesting parts of that answer. It's a 17-week season to play 16 games. Yet, except for maybe the end of next week until the middle of July, so about maybe 4 or 5 weeks, they dominate the news cycle all the time. There's never a shortage for you or anybody else at NFL Network.
Yeah, and last year on July 4th, unfortunately, Jason Pierre-Paul had a, you know, life-changing and career-changing hand injury on July 4th. So, you know, that stuff you never plan for or can foresee. But, yeah, it never sleeps, that's for sure. It never stops, it never sleeps. And it's interesting the way they've scheduled the entire calendar because, like you said, there is that natural month or so of breathing room, but not much else.
You mentioned your Yankees experience in which you worked for Yes and did a great job at Yes. No surprise to this veteran campaigner. But what is the difference between that experience and who you worked with there versus the current experience you're having with NFL Network?
Yeah, you know, well, Yes is Yankee-centric, and I give the folks at Yes a lot of credit. I said early on I wanted to be able to incorporate opponents and opponent stories in our coverage, and they were all for it. And I used to do you know, pregame interviews, they were lengthy. They were between 3 and 5 minutes. And I don't know about half of them being opponents, but it might have been about that. And it was fun, Steve. I look back now, I talked to, you know, Ken Griffey and Mike Piazza and Joe Maddon and David Ortiz, and the list goes on. And Yes allowed me to do that, and I give it a lot of credit. But it was a Yankee-centric. You had one team, you had one game. And the Yes actual production of the game, I think, measures up to any production you'll see by any network, including the major ones. So that's the biggest difference. Here, for example, next week I'll be at Giants Monday. I'll fly to Indianapolis, hopefully to get a quick interview with Andrew Luck. They have a mini camp. Their mini camp is next week. Wednesday I'll be back on Fitzpatrick duty at Jets. And then the following week, the Jets and Giants are among the majority of NFL teams who then have their mandatory mini camp before taking that break you alluded to. So I'll split those 3 days up between probably two at Jets, one at Giants at this point. So, you know, you just have to have a little bit more awareness of a few other other areas, whereas, you know, yes, I was mostly Yankee-centric, and rightly so.
There has never been a better basketball beat writer here than you were when you were at the Center Daily Times. What did the experience here as a starting point for you at least lay a foundation for what eventually you would do in your career?
I think that's an interesting question, Stephen. As you were asking it, I thought, I think back to it a lot, but not exactly in those terms. I think it's a great question. You know, I look back, Steve, on, and I can't tell you the year. I have to look up certain games. You know, I can't remember exactly what years, you know, the Crispin brothers were there. You know, I have to look up that kind of stuff. I don't have that kind of a memory. But I remember early on, now it's the 90s, but it's early on in my career, I had a question for Tom Izzo, and I remember Michigan State saying, if you wait in the hallway, and I guess it was after his press conference or whatever, he would answer the question, and he did, and he could not have been nicer. I mean, you know, I think you would agree, when you deal with Tom Izzo at any level, you know, he's so professional, and now look at him.
No doubt.
I remember times like that, that like a Tom Izzo gave me a couple minutes, you know, and at the time I'm asking him about Penn State basketball or someone with Penn State basketball, and that's not his priority. So I remember that. I remember covering, you know, the Matt Gaudio teams, John Amici. You know, John Amici ended up, you know, becoming someone who became known a few years ago and as a spokesman and everything else with gay athletes. But, you know, like, I covered him at Penn State and knew him back when, and at the time, and then more recently he and I did exchange messages. I just remember the people. I guess that's the best way I can explain it to you. And a lot of growing pains, Steve. I mean, I don't know about you. I look back on maybe not as much stories I wrote, but angles I took or questions I asked, and the edges could have been smoothed. You know, it could have been a better approach. It could have been different. It could have been this or that. And I think that's a part of growing. And now I think everything I do now was shaped back then, and hopefully you get better over time. I guess that would be the biggest answer. But I never, ever, ever take for granted those times covering Paterno, covering everyone, and God, we could talk for an hour, the Penn State football people. But, I mean, even, like, I'll give it to you this way. Even Michael Conforto plays for the Mets,
yes,
right? I claim him because his dad played at Penn State. So Penn State and that experience, never far from my mind.
That's one. Actually, Mikey Conforto, all right, Mike Conforto is actually one of the great stories here because he played on the Little League team from Redmond, Washington, that came in to play in the Little League World Series. Penn State had two-a-days, and they wanted to bring the Little League team down. His dad did, wanted to bring them down to meet Joe and meet the team. Well, they didn't know which one of the two practices to come up to, or come down to, I guess, from Williamsport. So the reporter from the Seattle Intelligencer went down to the morning practice with Jeff Nelson, but of course it was closed. Well, Robbie Gold missed 5 field goals in a row, and Joe was furious, and he stopped practice, and he stormed out, and he stormed past this guy. He said, I'm not talking to anybody, and kept on going. Then in the afternoon, the Little League team showed up, and there's Mike, and Mike had this big game the night before. He had a double, a triple, a home run. He made a great catch, and Joe's telling him, he said, I saw you get this hit, you made that catch. Mikey, you're just so much better of an athlete than your father. You know, the grandpa came out.
That's great.
So when I see Mike Conforto, because I was standing there when the whole thing happened, that's all I could think of.
That's terrific. If I meet him, Steve, I will mention that to him. That's terrific.
Yeah, it is. One final note. You know, you take a journey, as you talked about your journey just now to get to this point, and everything builds on, you know, to make you better, and you work with people who make you better. If I were to tell you 20 years ago this is what you'd be doing now, how surprised would you have been, and how much do you appreciate it?
I appreciate it every single day. I'm incredibly grateful. Would I have believed it 20 years ago? You would have had to catch me between waitressing shifts or bartending shifts at Soft Trees and the CDT work. So you would have caught me in between one of those. I certainly don't have the energy I had back then, I will tell you that. No, I wouldn't have believed you. I don't think I would have believed you. Steve, I wanted to be a writer. If you had told me I'd be a columnist or I'd get an opportunity to write for Sports Illustrated, I'm not saying I would have said, oh, sure, of course, but I would have certainly grabbed on to that quickly, and I would have said, I hope that's the case. That was my dream, and writing is still my first love. I could never have imagined this. I still don't know why in 2005 the YES Network hired me with no baseball experience and no TV experience to cover the Yankees. I truly don't know why. It's kind of a fun thing to look back on. And they probably don't know why either. And then 7 years later, I had a wonderful opportunity at NFL Network. But no, I wouldn't have believed you. And that's why, Steve, when I talk to young people, including Penn Staters, who reach out sometimes, not often enough, but some, that's a different topic, but sometimes they reach out, and I'm always I try to be happy to help. I tell them I can't pave the road for you. Because people will ask me, Steve, and I'm sure you appreciate this, how do I become the Yankees reporter?
Yes.
Well, there's one of those positions, in terms of my actual job. There's one. So you need to understand that the road's not paved. It's going to have a lot of potholes and turns and unexpected U-turns and, everything else. And you need to just be prepared to kind of go for it. And I remember thinking this, Steve, when I was offered the Yankees job. I don't know why they offered me this, but it certainly is a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
Right.
And I literally took it almost on that leap of faith, and it was a struggle early on. It was very much a struggle early on. But that's essentially why I made a life-changing decision, because I recognized it being such a rare opportunity that I couldn't explain, and therefore I thought it meant I had to kind of grasp on and try to make it, and it took a while. There was a lot of growing and a lot of learning, for sure. But to go back to the original, you're talking to someone who is incredibly grateful, and I keep that perspective daily. I promise you that.
Oh, believe me, I know, because obviously we've known each other for a while. I told the group the same thing last week, essentially. I said, look, there's 320 million people in the country. 65 people get to do Power 5 football, basketball. I said, you don't think you wake up every day and don't appreciate that? You don't know why somebody said you should be the one, but you appreciate every second of it because there are 65 of those jobs. That's it.
Yep, absolutely.
You're awesome. You know that. I've always told you that, and I appreciate the time, and I hope this isn't the last time we have you on. The audience loved hearing you.
Well, I don't know about that. I hope so. But two things, Steve, and I told you this privately at Pro Day. My TuneIn radio has you and Jack Ham and the Penn State Radio Network on it every Saturday, whether I'm home in the car or traveling, to listen to Penn State. So I am listening all the time, and you and Jack are terrific. And I told Sean, your producer, because he said I won't bug you by texting you and stuff. I said, bug me. I'll come on anytime you'd like, anytime. And we will certainly have more updates on Christian along the way, as you know. I mean, he's right now practicing a lot with other young players and rookies, and they're bringing him along slowly, which, is intentional and the right thing to do. But, eventually we'll have a lot to talk about with Christian Hackenberg here in this area.
Can't wait. Kim, thanks so much. It was great having you on.
Great talking to you, Steve. Thank you so very much. Have a wonderful day.
Kimberly Jones, NFL Network. Second hour of the show next on News Radio 1070 WKOK.